So this is the QRR practice, and I'm going to start with number 16, so it's out of order, but it's the stamina piece, so while you're fresh, hopefully. Ready. Finally, as to the fourth question, as I set out above, I consider the distinction between the position as to removal of nationals and non-nationals, together with the fact that the non-nationals, but for the problem of torture, could be removed, means that the difference in treatment does have an objective and reasonable justification. It remains for me to deal with certain other subsidiary points which are advanced. The first is linked to the position in relation to the procedure adopted by SIAC. It is submitted that the proceedings relate to a criminal charge within the meaning of Article 6, giving rise to the application of the presumption of innocence, the right to disclosure of the case against them and the material upon which it is based to the fullest possible extent. As to this, I agree with SIAC that the proceedings are not criminal. I would, however, accept the fact that the proceedings are civil proceedings within Article 6. The proceedings before SIAC involve departures from some of the requirements of Article 6. However, having regard to the issues to be inquired into, the proceedings are as fair as could reasonably be achieved. It is true that the respondents and their lawyers do not have the opportunity of examining the closed material. However, the use of separate counsel to act on their behalf in relation to the closed evidence provides a substantial degree of protection. In addition, in deciding upon whether there has been compliance within Article 6, it is necessary to look at the proceedings as a whole, including the appeal before this court. When this is done and the exception in relation to national security referred to in Article 6 is given due weight, I am satisfied there is no contravention of that article. The respondents also argued before SIAC and this court that the scheme of detention adopted by the 2001 Act contravened the principle in Article 3 ECHR that no one shall be subjected to torture or to inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment. I agree with SIAC that this argument must fail. The class of detainees with which we are concerned could not be deported by the government, and this is because of respect for their Article 3 rights. It was for precisely this reason that the scheme being challenged was adopted. It has not been shown that there is something in the manner of their detention which places it in the class of inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment to which Article 3 is directed. On the assumption that the respondent's detention is lawful, there is no evidence of that their detention, which is not intended to be punishment, is inhuman or degrading. In paragraph 21 of its decision, SIAC states, "We are satisfied that our proper function in the context of this case is to decide whether the decision that there was such an emergency as justified derogation was one which was reasonable on all the material or, to put it another way, was one which he, the Secretary of State, was entitled to reach. Taken in isolation, it is suggested this indicates SIAC were adopting the wrong approach of treating their role as the same as that on judicial review, the Wensbury approach. When the passage concerned is read in context, it is clear that SIAC well understood its role and in the passage, which is a subject of objection, were merely giving effect to the need to allow a reasonably wide margin of discretion. For example, at the beginning of paragraph 21, SIAC states, "We must, as the appellants have submitted, consider the material for ourselves and decide whether the decision that there exists a public emergency threatening the life of a nation can be supported." After the decision of SIAC, the Commissioner for Human Rights gave a carefully reasoned opinion on aspects of the United Kingdom's derogation from Article 5. He made certain critical comments. These comments deserve greatest attention, not only because of the distinguished status of the Commissioner, but because to an extent they are supported by the report of the Joint Committee of Parliament on Human Rights. It is right that this Court should take them into account if they assist the respondent's case. First, in relation to the inadequacy of the UK procedure with respect to derogations, he was concerned about the sequence of events which meant that the order was made before the first draft of the proposed bill was laid before Parliament. He suggested that the consequence was that two small parliamentary hurdles are substituted for one large one. This is not a matter with which the Court can deal, but is a matter for Parliament to deal with. However, on the material which is before us, it is difficult to accept that Parliament was unaware of what was intended at all material times. Certainly, the important matter was that the position was clear beyond peradventure before the Act was passed. As the order is of no value without the Act of 2001, there does seem to be, with respect, little in this point. In addition, on inquiry of the Attorney General, we were told, as we expected, that the practice of information being made available on Privy Council terms to the opposition was followed in this case. The Commissioner was also unhappy about the frequency of the review procedure of the legislation, in particular the sunset clause of 5 years. However, the legislation does require regular supervision by SIAC at the times I have already indicated. So that means that the present respondents will not suffer as a result of the 5 year period. The same applies to the reservation, the ground for which is neither specified or understood, which the Commissioner had as to the independence of the person appointed under Section 28(1) of the 2001 Act to review its operation. Finally, the Commissioner raises a number of points as to the appropriateness, the proportionality and the necessity of the action of which the UK government has taken. These are points which, not surprisingly, the respondents are also taking, and in the course of this judgment, I hope I have expressed my views upon them. I agree, however, with the Commissioner that action of this sort, which the UK government has taken, can be justified only under the most limited of circumstances. I have also considered the second and fifth reports of the Joint Committee of Parliament on Human Rights. The committee examined the bill, which became the 2001 Act. Both reports expressed concerns about the bill, which the committee had to examine at great speed. In the fifth report, the committee acknowledged that there had been improvements to the bill as a result of the second report. However, the committee still had a number of concerns. The first concern related to the power of detention. This should only be used where it is impossible or inappropriate to prosecute the detained person, and the Secretary of State is searching diligently for a safe country. There is nothing to suggest at this stage that this concern is not being met. The second and third concern, which relates to the jurisdiction of SIAC and the ability of the Secretary of State to rectify, also do not apply to the respondents at the present time. The fourth and final concern relates to special advocates being available to this court. At the beginning of the hearing, such advocates were available, but we released them as they would not be required. The reports, while valuable, do not therefore affect these appeals.